Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Hey, thanks for clicking on the latest podcast from peterbcollins.com. As our pronouncer told you, this program is supported by listeners who subscribe. And I want to thank Linda Gray, Bernice Del Orto, Cameron Troxell, and all the way in France, Gael Lagar, for your support of the Peter B. Collins Show. Before the end of this podcast, Will Durst is going to join us, the stand-up comic and sit-down satirist, with his take on the civil war that's broken out inside the Republican Party. But first, an outspoken Israeli-American, a guy who could claim to be part of the Zionist royalty of Israel, if he wanted. This is a fascinating conversation. Take a listen. Starting our conversations today at peterbcollins.com, a conversation with Miko Peled, an Israeli peace activist, a third-generation Zionist who has a very powerful personal story and a very powerful personal message. He practices diplomacy with a combination of his membership in the Rotary Club and his passion for martial arts. And he is the grandson of one of the Zionist founders of Israel who signed the Declaration of Independence. His father, Matty Peled, was an officer in the 1948 war and went on to serve with some distinction in the Israeli military, including a stint as the commander of the occupation of Gaza. And there are many other episodes that Miko Peled recounts in his new book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Miko Peled, welcome to our program today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, it's very nice to talk with you, and I really enjoyed your book. And we'll get into some of the history of your family and your father's illustrious career and how his shift into a peacemaker and a Jewish Israeli advocate for the rights of Palestinians shaped your own life. But I'd like to start in the present, because you and I are speaking a couple of days before the Academy Awards ceremonies in Los Angeles. And about 6 weeks ago, I viewed the film Five Broken Cameras and interviewed the brother of the filmmaker, Iyad Bernat. The filmmaker is Imad Bernat. And you know both of these brothers, and you have spent time in their village of Bilin, which had a population of about 2,000. And their lands, the olive groves that provided for their sustenance for centuries, they were taken by the Israelis, and it is all recounted in this powerful documentary, Five Broken Cameras. Tell me a little bit about your own participation in some of their Friday peace marches and your reaction to the film and its nomination for an Oscar.
Well, I heard of them for the first time when they began their the protests back in 2005. And I just drove up there to meet with them, spent a day with them. And I was incredibly impressed by their dedication, by their dedication to the cause and the dedication to the principle of a struggle, a nonviolent struggle. And now looking back, I'm even more impressed because these guys have been beaten up badly by the Israeli authorities, by the settlers, and they're relentless in their pursuit of justice. They're relentless in their pursuit of freedom for their people, freedom for Palestine, and they are relentless in their pursuit of seeking or conducting the struggle and remaining loyal to the principle of nonviolence. And they've accomplished a lot. Words can't express how pleased I am that the movie Five Broken Cameras is getting the kind of recognition that it's getting, that it's made it to the Oscars. I hope it wins. It certainly deserves to win. Michael Moore even is behind it and saying that it deserves to win, and I think that's wonderful. The treatment that Imad received, he and his family, when they landed at LAX, was shameful, unjustifiable, inexcusable, and quite typical. I can't imagine why somebody wasn't there to meet them and anticipate that they would be held the way they were just because they're Palestinians, because this is what Palestinians go through, even if they're American citizens, quite often. So why somebody wasn't there to meet them and greet them and take care of this in advance is beyond me. But there it is. I think it's typical.
Well, and let's point out that Imad also was subjected to a six-hour delay as he left the West Bank for Amman, Jordan, to fly to Los Angeles, and that is really a matter of daily life for Palestinians. They never know how long they will be held at an Israeli checkpoint. And let's underscore that these are not border crossings. These are checkpoints within the West Bank.
Yes, the treatment of Palestinians, both here in the U.S. and in other European Western countries and in Israel, is that they are guilty because they are Palestinians and therefore they deserve this kind of treatment. But the fact, what I think is troubling, is that nobody anticipated this. Nobody was out there to meet him in advance, because this is the part and parcel of Palestinian life, and somebody should have known this and somebody should have thought of it. And I think that's That's a very sad state of affairs. But anyway, he's in now. I believe Michael Moore was instrumental in getting him through and taking care of this and raising awareness for what happened. And I really hope that they win. I think it's a movie that deserves to win. It's a movie that is honest. It's accurate, and it demonstrates the struggle of the Palestinian people through what is taking place in Bilin. And today there are several, probably close to a dozen towns and villages that have taken on this model that Bilin created of a Friday or a Saturday afternoon protest. They all get beat up, they all get harassed, they all get arrested and tortured, their kids pay a price, and they are relentless after they get arrested, and they've all been arrested. They come back and they lead the marches once again at the first opportunity that they get. So I'm glad this is finally being exposed. I think it's a wonderful movie, like I said, and again, I'll say it again, I hope they win.
So, Miko, one of the ironies is that in the documentary category at the Oscars, there is a film also known as The Gatekeepers, which profiles six former heads of the Shin Bet security force in Israel, and their rather direct criticism of the policies of the Israeli government, in particular, the current Prime Minister, Bibi Netanyahu. Have you seen that film? I haven't had a chance to watch it yet.
It hasn't been aired here yet, but I've seen the interviews and I've seen the trailer and some of the extended interviews with the filmmaker that he's had with Christiane Amanpour and others. And I have to say that I've never seen such hypocrisy in my life. I think this is the epitome of Israeli propaganda. And I think these six men, rather than being paraded as heroes and brought to the Oscars, should all be sent to the International Criminal Court in The Hague and tried for their horrendous crimes.
And explain that.
The Shin Bet, or the Shabak, as it's called, is an organization that engages in the brutal killing of innocent civilians, in torture, in arresting of political figures because they are political figures. They have harassed, killed, and tortured, and brought to the wrongful incarceration of countless Palestinian clergymen and intellectuals and political leaders. Everybody knows in Israeli courts they lie in front of the judges in order to get convictions. and this is a criminal organization. And now these heads of this organization are pretending that there's no strategy. And one of the claims that they've made in the clips that I have seen and in the interviews that I've seen, they make the claim that the problem in Israel, that there's no strategy and therefore there's no peace. And I would argue that this is a lie, and they know it's a lie, because there is a strategy. Israeli strategy has always been ethnic cleansing. It's always been being brutalizing the Palestinians. And it's always been the ongoing expansion of Israeli towns and villages on Palestinian land. And these guys that headed this organization were responsible for assisting in bringing forward these policies. And now they're pretending as though they actually all they really wanted was peace. And I think it's such hypocrisy that it just cannot be tolerated. It just makes you sick to see them being paraded in this way as though they're somehow heroes.
Well, explain for our listeners the dynamics of Israeli politics, because it strikes me that it's very difficult for anyone to separate themselves from the official policies, and particularly if you have been a part of it, to then become a critic. Doesn't that make you a self-hating Jew? And aren't you marginalized in ways that are hard for many Americans to understand?
Well, it all depends on the level of criticism. I think if you take the people who are portrayed in this movie and the gatekeepers, then no, they are doing exactly what Israel likes to do, which is to portray this imaginary mythical image of Israel as a country and a people who actually always wanted peace, but had to deal with terror. This is not true. In fact, one of the statements that they make is, they talk about the fact that they were responsible for dealing with terror. Well, if they were honest, then they would know and they would say that this is not terrorism, that it's Palestinian resistance, and the terrorism is what Israel is engaging in against the Palestinians. Not the Palestinians are the terrorists, but mm-hmm. the entire Israeli defense machine is a machine of terrorism, and the Palestinians, having been left with no other choice quite often, engage in resistance, some of which is armed. And so calling, categorizing that as terrorism is hypocrisy. Beyond that, I don't, you know, in terms of Israeli perspectives and perhaps even some American perspective, you could say that I crossed the line, because I claim that there cannot be peace with Israel and therefore there has to be peace without Israel. Not that I or anybody else who says this is talking about violence. We're talking about a peaceful transformation of the state that exists today, which is a brutal racist state, into a democracy that includes Palestinians as well as Israelis. And some may use all kinds of names and terms to categorize what I say and do. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm not the only one that says and does this, so I don't want to make it seem as though I invented something new here. I'm part of a very respectable group of some very smart people. But they can choose to call us whatever they want to call us. I think the point remains that not what it means or if you're anti-Semitic, if you criticize Israel, but I think what's important is what does it make you when you support Israel? Because when you support Israel, you're supporting a state that holds thousands of political prisoners. You're supporting a state that has an organization like the Shabak that engages in brutal killing and torture and unjust incarceration of innocent people because of their politics. You're supporting a country, you're supporting a state, I should say, that as a matter of policy engages in killing innocent civilians on a regular basis in places like Gaza and other places in the West Bank, other places in Palestine, I should say, and around Palestine, like Lebanon. As a matter of policy, they kill civilians. They know they're killing hundreds and thousands of civilians, and they do it anyway. And you're engaged in, and you're supporting a state that has racist laws in its law books. And so what does that make you if you do support this, is, I think, the question. And people who do support the state of Israel, I think if they're not ashamed today, will come to be ashamed and to beg for forgiveness when the truth comes out and when the transformation is actually takes place from this brutal regime that we have today to a real democracy.
Well, you just gave a very direct and stunning indictment of Israeli policies and the government. And it begs the question, fundamentally, do those who run the government and set the policies want peace? Because
no.
It seems to me that the plan is just to wear down the Palestinians, to expropriate as much of their property, land in particular, as they can, to marginalize them and hope that they simply go away. And it doesn't appear to me that the United States is interested in trying to push Israel in any meaningful way into a new peace process. President Obama has announced that he's going to make his first trip to Israel in March. But they've also made it clear that he's not going with any particular plan. And the Netanyahu government has announced they're going to give him some special award. And this all seems pretty bizarre to me because, from my point of view, America's alliance with Israel and its excessive support for the extreme policies of the Netanyahu government presently are at the root of many of our international problems. And that we can't really square away our military occupations and the conflicts that continue to erupt as long as we maintain that there is this lockstep between American foreign policy and Israeli policies.
Yeah, I think the question you raised at first, whether Israel wants peace, is very easy to answer. And I think the answer is no. But I think you need to look back and understand, in order to understand why this is true, we need to look back at how the State of Israel was created. The State of Israel was created as a result of a 12-month period where Palestinians were terrorized by armed militia, by the Israeli, or this is before Israel was established, the Zionist armed militia. My father was an officer in that militia, and throughout all of 1948, or from the end of 47 till the end of 48, and for a period of about 12 months, the Palestinians who were unarmed and a civilian, completely civilian population who did not have any kind of military force at all were terrorized to a point where close to 1 million people were forced into exile. Hundreds and hundreds of towns and cities were destroyed. And 80% of Palestine almost was conquered by these militias because, of course, there was no opposition, no serious military opposition. And the State of Israel was established on this Arab country. Again, as a result of a massive terrorist attack. And there you have it. And then you have the State of Israel inside Palestine, and you had hundreds of thousands of Palestinian refugees sitting all around in refugee camps wondering what in the world had happened. So when you have a state that begins like that, you know, that is founded on that, then there's not much that you can hope for in terms of peace. Now, 20 years later, there was another war in 1967, the rest of Palestine. The other 22% of Palestine were conquered. And in terms of the conquest, the mission of the State of Israel and the mission of Zionism was accomplished, which was the step one, as I said, was conquest. So they conquered the land. Once Israel conquered the West Bank, by the way, and the Gaza Strip in 67, again, they engaged a massive campaign of ethnic cleansing, destroying towns and cities, and once again, building for Israeli Jews only on that Palestinian land. So I don't know what it is that makes people think that Israel is a state that would ever want peace with the Palestinians. Israel is a state that's been engaged in ethnic cleansing and destruction of Palestine, and in its place is building this new thing for Israeli Jews only. And that's how it's been, and it's been all the different prime ministers and all the different political parties that have been in power have always engaged in the exact same policies. I don't think Bibi Netanyahu is any worse or any different than David Ben-Gurion, who was the first prime minister, or Golda Meir, or any other prime minister along the way. They are all in the same, they're all following and they're all executing the exact same policies, the end of which is that the land of Israel, which is what they call Palestine, belongs to the Jewish people, and peace is not part of the program. We need to get rid of these other people who are there, the Palestinians, and if it takes 100 years, it takes 100 years. And to settle it with Israeli Jews and to build for Israeli Jews. And again, therefore, this is why they have thousands of political prisoners. This is why they have racist laws that discriminate against Palestinians. That's why they engage in these massive attacks of terror against Palestinians, you know, every so often on a pretty regular basis in Gaza and other places. And peace, of course, is not part of it. Now, no American the Israeli lobby has been so effective in Washington, starting even before the establishment of the State of Israel, the Zionist lobby was very powerful, very strong, very effective. That today, no American politician can say anything against Israel. I mean, if you want to be, if you want to have a career in politics in America, you have to support Israel. That's the cost of doing business. And this is true for the president. He knows there's nothing he can do that is will make any difference at all. So why try? Why bother? Why get into this, you know, cesspool of problems when he has other issues that he wants to deal with? It's a lot easier to just, you know, remain with the same policies. And there's nothing new that he can offer because everything that he has to offer has already been proven that as it's not going to work. Without criticizing Israel, he's not going to get anywhere. And criticizing Israel is not permissible.
So, Mikko, this is very interesting, and I appreciate your strong and passionate commentary. And at the same time, there's a contrast with the message in your book, which is that you engage in personal diplomacy. You have created discussion groups of Jews and Palestinians, and you, as I mentioned at the outset, you have used your membership in Rotary to raise awareness, to bridge some of the divides. So you are a very active peacemaker in your own right, and at the same time, you seem to have no hope for a peace process, at least under the current conditions.
No, I'm very hopeful. I'm very hopeful, and I think creating bridges between the two, between Israelis and Palestinians, is an important part of the solution. And I think engaging other groups, whether they be Rotary or churches and so forth, to engage them in the process is very important. I think, though, that a realistic approach to peace is one that understands that Israel cannot be, it doesn't want to be a partner to peace, and therefore Israel has to be removed from the equation. Peace will come when there is no state of Israel as it is today. It's like in South Africa. The only other, you know, a good parallel would be, a good example would be South Africa. You had to get rid of apartheid in order to move on, and that's what you have to do in Israel. You have to get rid of Israel or the Zionist state, because that is the apartheid. That is the problem that is creating the friction. That is the problem that is not allowing us to have peace. Once there is a democratic state where Israelis and Palestinians live as equals and share the land, but also share their fate politically and economically and so forth, and you don't have one side that's monopolizing the other, manipulating the other, then you can have peace. But you can't have peace when you have 6.5 million people trying to brutally govern 6 other million people because they're not Jewish. Israel is, and I think this is an important point to make, by the way, I don't think Israel is a Jewish state, even though they claim they are. It's just a state that favors Jews, which is a completely different thing. Most Jews have never been to Israel, probably will never be in Israel, and many of them don't even care. Not to mention those who oppose Israel and think like I do. But the bridging the gap is important because Israelis and Palestinians do have problems they're going to have to bridge. But the state of Israel, as it is, has to be transformed into a real democracy that includes all, you know, 10 or 11 million people who live there on an equal basis with complete equality, regardless of whether they're Jewish or not, regardless of whether they're Israeli or Palestinian.
Mikko, talk about your own odyssey, because it's fascinating that, as you pointed out, your father fought in the removal of the Palestinians in 1948. He went on to serve for several decades in the Israeli military. But he became an advocate for the rights of the Palestinians after he retired and became a professor. And you seem to be heavily influenced by that. And during your own mandatory service in the Israeli military, it appears that that was a kind of a turning point period in your life.
Yes, well, you know, we live and we grow and we learn things and we develop. Hopefully that's the path that we all take in life. Otherwise, we stay in one place, we remain stuck in one place. I've had the good fortune that I've had, you know, two parents who have had an openness and a family that has been open to this issue. And it was not tainted by the typical racism that we see in Israel and by the typical one-sided discourse that we see in Israel. And yes, my father, while in the military, he already spoke about the need to solve the Palestinian problem based on a resolution that recognized as Palestinian rights, whether they're Palestinians or Israeli citizens that deserve equal rights, or these are the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. And at that time, he spoke about the need to recognize their rights to independence as an independent state. And then to that end, he dedicated the rest of the second half of his life after he retired from the military. My journey began a little bit later on after my father passed away. 2 years after that, as you probably read in the book, my niece was killed in a suicide attack by Palestinians. And I won't go into that too much, only to say that that drove me to a deeper investigation and inquiry and a real journey into Palestine, which is a country I didn't know existed, and to see Palestinians, which were people that I never knew and never met. And because I was living in the States, I was able to meet with Palestinians as equals, which is something that cannot happen back in Israel / Palestine, because there is no equality there. So when we would meet, they did not need permits, and there was no curfew, and we were completely equal under the law. And that set me on this path of realizing that there is another story, learning about this other story, traveling into Palestinian communities, getting in a car and traveling to Bel'in to meet with Iyad, Imad Burnat, and others, and so forth, and to really familiarize myself with this whole other story, with this whole other nation, with this whole other reality that I grew up right next door to but had no access to. And today, having done that for over a decade, I realize without any doubt that the state of Israel had never intended to make peace, that peace was never part of Israeli or Zionist strategy. And the only way to move beyond the conflict, or I should say it this way, the two options that we have or that exist at all are maintaining this racist apartheid regime and reality that discriminates heavily against Palestinians and prefers Jewish people, even though half the population are Palestinian Arabs, or moving to a democracy, which means getting rid of this racist notion of a Jewish-only state, and allowing Israelis and Palestinians to move forward and meet their potential and create a future for themselves in this country that they share.
And Miko, describe the Gaza Strip, because you made a visit there and you left just a week or two before Operation Cast Lead, which occurred during the period after Obama was elected but before he took office. And it appeared that Israel took advantage of that kind of vacuum in American leadership to launch a brutal assault where 1,400 Palestinians, including an estimated 800 women and children, were killed in a roughly 21-day assault.
Yes, well, actually, at that opportunity, I wasn't able to visit Gaza. We tried to visit Gaza, and I was held at the border on the Egyptian side for several days before I realized that I was not going to be able to get in. As an Israeli citizen, Israeli law prohibits me from entering Gaza, so I can't enter through the Israeli side.
I see.
Because I have an American passport, I can try through the Egyptian side. I've tried that particular time and failed. I tried a couple of years later, and I failed. And finally, just a few weeks ago, I had the opportunity to go in through one of the tunnels that starts on the Egyptian side of Gaza and goes into the Palestine side of Gaza, or I should say the city of Rafah, not Gaza. And I did that, and finally I was able to spend some time in Gaza and enter. But again, I had to be smuggled in, and I had to break about 52 different laws of three different countries in order to do this, which I did happily. But the point is that Gaza is it's about 140 square kilometers. Close to 2 million people live there. There's a siege that was placed upon Gaza by Israel, Egypt, and the United States. And so these 2 million people are subject to living in basically an open air prison. The only reason there isn't total starvation in Gaza, is because on the boundary, on that very narrow boundary between the Gaza Strip and Egypt, which is less than 10 kilometers wide, there are close to 1,500 tunnels through which the people of Gaza bring in everything they need, from medical equipment to medicine to food to oil to money. everything you can imagine goes through these tunnels. They are very well run. They're very well administered by the Gazan government. And it's the only way for people to go in and out as well, because oftentimes going through Israel or going through Egypt is not a possibility. But it's a crime, because if you can imagine the having 2 million people live in such a narrow strip of land to begin with, about half of those people are children, and about half of that entire population are refugees from other parts in Palestine that were forced to live as refugees in 1948. And now they're living under the siege. Travel is prohibited. Any kind of import-export is prohibited. No escape routes are available to them. And yet Israel attacks them from the air and from the ground viciously, like they did it, operated, like you said, at the end of 2008, beginning of 2009, a vicious, murderous attack. And then again, just a few months ago.
Mm-hmm.
You are hard pressed to find a family in Gaza that has not had casualties. Quite often, there'd be 2, 3, 4, 5, some families as many as 13, 15 family members killed in an airstrike. And Israel does this knowing full well that they're killing civilians, because there's never been a military force there. There is no military force in Gaza. And this is the reality, and the world somehow accepts this, and the world somehow accepts that this is how it's going to be. Israel has no plan for Gaza. It's projected that by 2020 there will be close to 2.5 million people living there. This is not sustainable. Besides being immoral, unjust, and inexcusable, it's also unsustainable. You can't keep people. And, you know, this is an hour drive from Tel Aviv. It's an hour and 15-minute drive from Jerusalem, from major cities where there's hospitals and there's an industry and, normal Western kind of cities. I don't think Israel is going to be able to sustain it for very much longer, and I think that's a good thing. I think Israel is going to fall. This current regime, this non-democratic reality, is going to fall and be replaced by a democracy. I think it's inevitable.
Now, Israel has succeeded in dividing the Palestinian political forces into Hamas and Fatah, and they often struggle with each other. Hamas is currently running Gaza, Fatah, the West Bank. Fatah has declared the state of Palestine and has acquired this visitor or observer status at the United Nations. Do you see a way to unite the Palestinians, or does Israel just have so many wedges, including control of the water supplies, controlling of cash flows, and other critical factors that will, you know, basically maintain this split?
Well, the fragmentation of Palestinian society and Palestinian political life is probably one of Israel's biggest accomplishments. It goes far beyond just Gaza and the West Bank or Fatah and Hamas. You have within Israel, Israel decided that the Druze community are not Palestinian, so they don't call them Palestinians, they call them Druze. You have the Palestinians who are Israeli citizens, and Israel calls them the Arabs of Israel. They don't recognize that they're Palestinians, and they differentiate between them and the Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza. Then you have the Palestinians who live in exile, the refugees. That's a whole other entire community. And once again, Israel has created, artificially at least, this divide between the Palestinians on the outside and the Palestinians on the inside, whereas Israel doesn't even negotiate, doesn't even begin to talk about the Palestinians who are refugees who are waiting for the day when they can return to their homes. And I hope that day comes sooner rather than later. So, but this is all Israeli creation. This is all artificial. If you talk to Palestinians, they are Palestinians. They don't care about Hamas or Fatah or this or that or the other. They don't see a division. I mean, they realize that there are divisions that were imposed upon them. But in reality, Palestinians are Palestinians. And Palestinians, when I meet Palestinians, whether they're from Gaza, whether they're from Lebanon in the refugee camps or Jordan or whether from any other place or whether they're Israeli citizens, they know that they're Palestinians and they know that they're part of this one nation and they know that this is their homeland and they know that this is, in other words, they know that they're part of this reality. So these divisions exist mostly in the heads of Israelis, in the minds of Israelis and Americans and others who are not, you know, as familiar as they should with this issue. And of course, it's a reality in that it was been imposed upon the Palestinians. And so people from Gaza can't visit their family in the West Bank, and people who are in refugee camps can't visit their homes inside of Israel, inside of Palestine. But again, this has been imposed by Israel. It's artificial. It's not true. And it's not a division that really exists among Palestinians.
So, Miko, finally, what do you advocate as a path forward? Do you see a one-state solution where Palestinians are integrated into Israeli society with full rights? Do you see a two-state solution? Can that work and really be fair to the Palestinians? Or is there a third way?
No, I think we have two options. One, Israel created one state over all of Palestine. Israel integrated the West Bank into the rest of Israel. There is no difference today between the West Bank or other parts of Palestine. In terms of the state, it's done. It's one state. It's a state of Israel over the entire land of Israel or the entire land of Palestine. Division is not an option anymore. Partition is not an option. That's done. The two options that exist today are continuing with this reality where you have the state of Israel, which claims to be a Jewish state, even though half the population is not Jewish, kind of imposed on the Palestinian population in this country that, by the way, was an Arab country until Israel showed up and destroyed it, or tried to destroy it. So that's one option, to keep it the way it is, kind of perpetual apartheid, perpetual living in perpetual violence and terrorism by the state of Israel, or moving and conducting efforts or engaging in efforts that will bring forth the end of this Israeli regime and Israeli rule and a real democracy where Israelis and Palestinians are fully integrated in one state. And I think it's a very realistic approach. I think it's a very doable solution. It's a solution that can be done. We have plenty of examples around the world where you have multi-nation states and everybody gets along very well. They don't need to love each other, but they do live in the same state, and the state functions as it is, and it represents the entire population. And I don't see why Israelis and Palestinians can't do this. I think it's the only solution that's out there. And I think, like I said earlier, this one democracy where Israelis and Palestinians live as equals is not only the just thing to do and the right thing to do, but it's also inevitable. It's the only option there is, because the two societies in many ways are already merging in many ways, but you have the racist laws and the reality of this racist, brutal regime of the state of Israel that's keeping them apart, from keeping this integration from taking place. So if we remove that, just like apartheid was removed in South Africa, if we remove this in Palestine, then we can have a thriving society, a democratic society, where Israelis and Palestinians can create a future together and live like any other normal state.
Miko, we often hear about demography and how the Arab population and the Palestinian population in particular is so dominated by those under the age of 30. I want to flip that and ask about demography related to the leadership of Israel. As the original Zionists die off, is there the opportunity for the kind of one-state solution that you just described? Do we need to wait for time to pass until the real hardliners fade, or are they simply being replaced by a new generation?
Well, the people who lead Israel today are the new generation. Bibi Netanyahu is the new generation. If you look at the last elections, Yair Lapid and all these other new guys that just came up, they're all young. This is a new generation of the same racist kind of ideology. So this is not going to happen as a result of somehow an Israeli prime minister realizing that it's time to make peace or it's time to do the right thing. Israelis are going to be forced into this. There's no question about that. You know, I don't think any group of people that is privileged has ever given up their privilege, without a fight, without a struggle. They're going to have to be pushed out of this privilege, and one day they wake up and they realize that they're no longer in control. And so this is not a question again of a generation dying away, because the new generation of Israelis are the same. Like I said, the new Israeli leadership is ideologically committed to the destruction of Palestine, to the killing of Palestinians, and to building for Israelis only, Israeli Jews only in Palestine, just as the founders were. But this will come, I think, as a result of pressure from the outside, of resistance, like places like Bilin and others, as a result of a very very positive growing awareness here in the U.S. and in other places in the West that are realizing that supporting Israel is the wrong thing to do. There are movements on campuses, there are movements in churches, there are movements in peace groups that are realizing that peace is only going to be possible when there is no Israel. Israel cannot be taken into account. Israel has to go, as the Jewish state has to go, or this notion of a Jewish state, again, has to go in order for peace and justice to happen, to come about in Palestine. And so, again, it's not going to come, and it's not going to come as a result of an American president either, because American policymakers and American politicians are the same as Israeli politicians. They all follow the same ideology, and they're all stuck in the same political point of view. It's going to be a grassroots movement that forces them to change.
Miko Pellet, his new book is called The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And now, San Francisco funny man Will Durst shares his commentary about the Civil War inside the Republican Party.
Hey guys, Will Durst here with a few words about the Civil War supposedly raging inside the Republican Party. Yes, again. As you probably heard, Karl Rove recently announced the creation of a new super PAC called the Conservative Victory Party, which you gotta admit is an odd name from the guy who famously had an election night hissy fit on Fox News because Mitt Romney wasn't being victorious. Wait, 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 it's not over. There's a cul-de-sac in a suburb on the outskirts of Cleveland Heights that hasn't checked in yet. Hey, let me go. My arm doesn't bend that way. The idea is to back moderates in primary elections, so Republicans don't have to enter the generals supporting some bat guano crazy candidate like Christine I Am Not a Witch O'Donnell or Todd Magic Fallopian Tube Aiken. Of course, the Tea Party has taken offense to this move, viewing it as counterproductive to their bat guano crazy candidates. So you got those guys going at it. Then Kentucky Senator Rand Paul insisted on giving an unofficial response to the official State of the Union response by the extremely thirsty Florida Senator Marco Rubio. And Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal gave a speech saying the GOP needs to stop being the stupid party. Yes, he did. And the fact that he said it out loud in front of cameras was, well, stupid. This is like one of those old cage battles royale put on by the World Wrestling Federation back in the early 80s, where 15 guys got into the ring with a chair, beat each other up, and the last one standing wins. Man, that's what the GOP needs, a Hulk Hogan to put everyone back in their place. Although to me, Karl Rove has always seemed more like a Rowdy Roddy Piper type. For the Peter B. Collins Show, I'm Will Durst.
Thanks a lot for listening. Your comments are welcome. Shoot me an email, humblehost@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling.